Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the Q&A session, if you'd like to ask a question, you may press star one on your phone. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Benjamin Haynes. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Ted. And thank you all for joining us today for this briefing to update you on CDC's COVID-19 response. You're joined by CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield, Deputy Secretary of Education Mitchell Zase, and Dr. Aaron Salberschatz, the lead of CDC's Community Interventions and Critical Populations Task Force. Today, our speakers will provide opening remarks and discuss new CDC resources and tools to help schools open safely this fall. At this time, I will turn the call over to Dr. Redfield.
Thank you, Ben, and thank all of you for joining us today. Last fall, more than 55 million students filled the classrooms of elementary, middle schools, and high schools nationwide. By the end of March this year, the same classrooms were deserted. The COVID-19 pandemic has affected all parts of our society, including our school system. The unique and critical role that schools play makes it a priority to open schools safely this fall and help them stay open. This will enable students to receive both the academic instruction and support, as well as other critical services. Schools are an important part of the infrastructure of our communities. They provide safe, supportive learning environments for students, employ teachers and other staff, and enable parents and guardians and caregivers to work. Schools also provide critical services that help to mitigate health disparities, such as school meal programs, and social, physical, behavioral, and mental health services. School closures disrupt the delivery of these critical services to children and families and places additional economic and psychosocial stress on families. In order to prioritize opening schools safely and helping them remain open, we need communities to adopt the actions to slow the spread of COVID now. We owe it to our nation's children to take personal responsibility, to do everything we can to lower the levels of COVID-19 so they can go back to school safely. I understand the trepidation many feel as they think about the upcoming school year. Well, now it's usually a time for finalizing lesson plans and buying school supplies and figuring out what classes to take, stress and worry about preventing teachers, parents, and students from taking these steps. The experts here at CDC have been working since March to address these issues, consulting with states, schools, and partners on how to best get children and teenagers back into the classroom safely. The resource and the tools that we are releasing today are intended to help everyone, teachers, students, parents, guardians, caregivers, and administrators, to get back to school as safely as possible. Now, I would like to turn the call over to Mark Zase. Mark?
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank CDC for hosting today's press call and for providing me an opportunity to speak on behalf of Secretary DeVos. Our entire team here at the Department of Education, the President, and the Vice President are proud to partner with CDC and parents from across America to get students back in the classroom this fall. President Trump is leading a great American recovery. An essential part of that recovery is getting our kids back in school. The default needs to be that schools are fully open and operational in the fall so that students can resume full-time learning. In areas where there are hot spots, remote and distance learning might need to be adopted for a certain amount of time, but the research and science continue to suggest that it is safer, healthier, and better for students to be in school full-time. It's not a matter of if it should be done, but rather how it must be done. The urgency is real. Personal engagement between teachers and students and among students and their peers is more important than ever. Too many government schools already failed their students this past spring. It can't happen again this fall. Getting our kids back in the classroom is a vital step in the national fight to defeat an invisible enemy. Thus far, Secretary of Education DeVos and the department have provided timely information and important flexibilities to support schools, educators, and families during this pandemic. Importantly, we've implemented the CARES Act in the way Congress wrote it to support all students, no matter where they go to school. And in the process, we've dispersed more than $30 billion taxpayer dollars. Children are adversely affected when they stay home because they're not getting the services they would receive in a full-time school setting. Parents also suffer. The collective earnings losses are estimated for the 5.6 million parents who are unable to work due to school closures to be nearly $232 billion. Continued school closures will have enormous consequences for children and communities, with the most severe impacts on the most vulnerable students. A great percentage of them are students of color and students from low-income families. We must do better for all of our children. They are our hope, our pride, and our shared future. We're doing everything we can to ensure that learning continues. How this happens is best left to education and community leaders with consideration of the guidance issued by CDC today. Local leaders should examine real data for their own states and communities and weigh all the factors, including mental health, physical health, safety, and social-emotional development. In this process, teachers are essential workers. They are essential in shaping the next generation of young minds. In individual situations where teachers have underlying conditions or do not feel safe returning to the classroom, the secretary has said that those individual teachers should work with their local school districts to develop a solution. We recognize that school may look different this fall. That's fine. But this is an opportunity to show our children that with some ingenuity and creative thinking, we can overcome most any challenge. Our schools will be stronger and more student-focused than ever before. The administration is working with Congress to ensure that schools have the resources they need to reopen safely. And if schools still refuse to reopen, the president has said that parents should receive the money that would be used for their child's education to find a school that is willing to educate their child full-time, whether that's a public charter school, a private school, or a faith-based school. As we prepare to reopen, we recognize that each individual student is just that, a unique individual. Each one deserves personalized learning in ways and places that work for them. The challenges we face demand action, and America always was and always will be a country of doers. We're confident that with grit and determination and a measure of grace, we can and will do what's right for all the students in our nation. Thank you very much. I will now turn it over to Dr. Aaron Sabershatz.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. I'm happy to speak with you all today about the critical topic of opening our schools safely this fall. Start by saying opening our schools is not a simple decision. There are both benefits and risks for students, teachers, staff, and communities that must be weighed. As you are aware, COVID-19 is a new disease, Every day, CDC and our public health partners around the world are learning more about SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. This includes how the virus spreads, how it affects children, and what role children might play in spreading SARS-CoV-2. The data we currently have about COVID-19 among children suggests that children are less likely to get COVID-19 than adults. And when children do get COVID-19, they generally have less serious illness. To put this in perspective, as of July 21st, 6.6% of all COVID-19 cases in the United States, which accounts for 192,760 cases, were among those under the age of 18. Turning to the death data, less than 0.1% of all COVID-19-related fatalities in the U.S. have been among children less than 18. Although the scientist in me acknowledges that this is a very small percentage, I am also a mom. In both roles, I am heartbroken that 64 children and adolescents under the age of 18 have died from COVID-19. While every death from COVID-19 is tragic, I cannot imagine losing a child. Of course, it's not just our children we're protecting at school. The risk of severe illness from COVID-19 is higher among our teachers, school staff, and administrators than children. Our resources are developed to support the health and well-being of everyone who passes through the school doors. As Dr. Redfield said, decisions about how to reopen schools safely should be made on local needs and the level of community transmission. Each school and each community will have different needs and should implement the strategies that meet those needs. We understand that the characteristics of each community and school will differ. This includes who lives, works, and learns there. Decisions should also take into account those who are at increased risk of getting COVID-19 or experiencing severe illness from COVID-19. That is why last night and this morning, CDC released new resources and tools to support schools, parents, guardians, and caregivers, as well as communities working to open schools safely in the fall. These resources focus on K-12 schools and include an update on the impact of COVID-19 among children, decision-making tools for parents, guardians, and caregivers, considerations for symptom screening in schools, the use of face masks in schools, checklists for parents, and an FAQ for administrators. CDC is committed to supporting students, teachers, school administrators, and other school staff, as well as parents, as they prepare for and open schools safely this fall, respond to cases in their school and any evolving outbreaks in their communities, and help them to adjust if and when needed so that they can continue to operate safely throughout the school year. To do this, we're seeking and sharing the most current information we have. We're providing resources and tools based on the latest science and updating these resources and tools as we learn more about this virus and what we know works to combat it. CDC will continue to develop new resources, including more for institutions of higher education, and update the resources and tools that we have in order to improve how we support communities. We're going to support communities by monitoring and evaluating the impact of school openings on the transmission of SARS-CoV-2. We're listening and learning from the people on the ground who are implementing strategies and coming up with innovative ways to keep schools safe. And we're collaborating with our partners who understand the unique needs and challenges schools face and are working with us towards the same goal to open schools safely. Thank you very much. We look forward to taking your questions now.
Thank you. Ted, we're ready to open up for questions.
The phone lines are now open for questions. If you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press *1 and record your name. Also, please limit yourself to one follow-up question. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press *2. One moment for the first question. First question is from Evan Brown with Fox News. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much, and good morning or good afternoon. I was able to take a look at the guidelines as they were released yesterday. What is the role that CDC hopes these guidelines will ultimately play? Because not every school district is seeming so willing to go ahead and open schools. Obviously, from district to district and county to county, state to state, people have different ideas. Why do you think these guidelines are going to be the most safe? And what guidelines, or maybe you could talk about how the guidelines evolved, and what were there any more stringent rules at some point that you did away with, and what were the reasons for that?
Well, I'll start, Evan. Dr. Redfield, we've been working on guidelines for schools. Actually, I think our first guidance was posted back in February, and additional in March, more in May. We've continued to try to update these guidance based on the data and the information that we have. And, you know, recently we issued our overall guidelines for reopening schools. And what this is a series of additional resource documents and consideration documents to really help put some more granular detail and how administrators and parents can begin to think about operating and putting those guidelines into a practical plan. It's important, though, our all of the material that we have put out are guidelines or resource material or consideration documents. They're all put out with the intent to help facilitate, as was mentioned earlier, the full reopening of schools for face-to-face learning. They're not really put out there to be a rationale for somehow to keep schools closed. Again, we're prepared to work with each jurisdiction as they try to adopt those guidelines based on the local public health advice that they have and the local school board advice they have. So that's their intent, they're really there to help individuals begin to work through the number of issues that are there to help get individuals back to school. And as we said, to do that safely, to understand the importance of making the appropriate accommodations for teachers that have significant risk as well as for students. I've mentioned before in the air that my 11 grandchildren, one of my grandchildren has cystic fibrosis. So we have to be able to figure out how to provide effective learning in a safe environment for all students. And for all teachers, but the goal line is to get the majority of these students back to face-to-face learning.
Next question, please.
Yes, next question is from Laura Meckler with Washington Post. Your line is now open.
Thanks so much. You've mentioned a few times that in hot spots that you may need to keep schools closed for a time. My question is, how much of the country right now would you consider to be a hot spot? Because a lot of times we look at this and we see a large swath of the country across the southeast and the west, southwest, with a lot of cases. And so are those considered hot spots? And are we talking about a huge part of the country? Is it appropriate for them not to open right now? And if you don't mind, a second question, which is, how much influence did the White House have in writing these documents, these new documents? Thank you.
So when you look at the hotspots, I think most of us right now are looking where the percent positivity rate within the community is greater than 5%. And a lot of times the maps you see aren't in a granular enough area to just let you see exactly. Rather than light up a whole state, it may be really several counties that meet that criteria. And it is quite dynamic. It is changing. A number of counties now are substantially improving. There's several counties getting where there's an increase in the percent positive. That's why it's so important for the local education boards and local health departments to look exactly at the data in their environment at this moment in time. But I can say across the nation, I don't have the exact percent for you, but we're happy to have our people go and look and get back to you. But a majority of the nation right now actually has positivity rates that are less than 5%. So clearly there's many parts of our nation that are having infection rates that would not be inconsistent with, again, our guidance, and it's just guidance to consider to be more cautious, particularly in those areas that have prevalence rates percent positive more than 10%. And the documents that we put out were developed by CDC, the one parent heading document that's over the top about the whole child and the health considerations, a document that was prepared by HHS, which we thought was important to conclude. We had CDC members on that team that put that document together along with SAMHSA, along with HHS, because we thought it was important for parents and teachers and decision makers to understand some of the significant health considerations. I think people have heard me say, and I mean this again as a grandfather for 11, that it's in the best public health interest of the K through 12s for them to get back in school. There were many negative public health consequences that happened to the K through 12 individuals as a consequence of school closure. And again, so we're a strong advocate to work through with the school districts how they can take the guidance and the consideration documents and the resource documents that we've prepared and how can they operationalize those in their school to get their students back to face-to-face learning.
So are you saying that one intro document was written, you said HHS, but also had White House input into it as
no,
well?
No, I said it was an HHS document. And in that, there was people from SAMHSA, which is part of HHS, and there were people from CDC that worked to help put that document together. I wasn't the author of that. I'd have to we can get whoever was the final author of that document to tell you what other influences, if there were any, that went into that document.
Next question, please.
Next question is from Evie Blad from Education Week. Your line is now open.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one, did the White House review or suggest any revisions to these documents before you release them? The second question is, there seems to be a change from the supplemental guidance you released earlier in the spring about universal screenings at schools, and we've noticed that a lot of schools have those in their plans. Can you talk a little bit more about that change?
Yeah, first, all of the material, you know, I'm a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, so there is a clearance process where documents go up through HHS, through OMB, and if other agencies are involved. For example, in this document, clearly education's involved, clearly labor's involved, where they have interagency review, and each of these agencies make comments. And it's a reiterative process until we get to a document that is ultimately cleared by OMB. And the truth is, having watched it, it's a very useful process. So sometimes some of the considerations that may not be had thought through because we may look at it from, say, the CDC point of view, but not realizing there's another angle from, say, education, another angle from labor. So that's just the standard process, and I've found it to be a very useful process. Ultimately, the document then comes back to me for my final review and concurrence for release. And I forgot your second question. I'm sorry.
Community screenings, actually, symptom screenings. Why are you not recommending universal ones? And a lot of schools already have that in their plan.
Yeah, I think really what we're trying to do is, you know, provide guidance and let the individual jurisdictions see how the different strategies that we put out could be best employed in there. You know, for example, looking for individuals that are actually frankly ill is obviously something that we recommend, and if they are ill, actually have them go home. It's much more likely that in this age group, if they prevent symptoms of illness, that they have something other than COVID. But that said, they don't need to bring that into the school. So I do think it's going to, you know, there's no recommendation against it. It's just that we're not necessarily mandating that everybody has to take this universal approach. We'll see how the different school districts decide to put together the portfolio strategies into their, as I mentioned, into what's their final practical approach. And as I said, CDC is prepared to provide technical assistance and consultation to schools or school districts to help them understand in their situation, in their environment, how do they take the best of what we recommend and get it into something that is operationally practical for them to be able to reopen their school.
Ted, we have time for two more questions.
Okay. Next question is from Hillary Brewick with Business Insider. Your line is now open.
Hey, can you hear me there?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I just wanted to talk quickly about a Kaiser poll that was taken last week that showed a majority of parents would prefer for schools to open later this fall, and that majority is even higher, 76% among parents of color. So, you know, I'm sure you're well aware that clearly families are worried about getting sick at school. So what reassurance can you give these parents, or what message would you have for this majority of parents in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think one of the important things that we are trying to do, I mean, I understand the trepidation and I understand the worry. I think all of us that have had parents, that have been parents, and I had six children, unfortunately, one of which died earlier in my time as a parent. I think what we're trying to do is give, factual, practical understanding, particularly which I do should be fairly reassuring that, as was mentioned by our colleague, Dr. Sarbasats, is that when we looked at mortality, we have, for under the age of 18 right now, 6 months into this pandemic, we're looking at the mortality for those under 18, about 0.1 per 100,000 or 1 in a million. And I always try to compare that to influenza, where the mortality during the same period of time over the last 5 years has ranged from anywhere from 6 times to 13 times higher than what we currently experience from COVID. So try to arrest people that this is really not a serious significant pathogen in individuals under 18. That said, it can be quite serious if there's someone that has significant comorbidities at home and the child happened to be infected. And so these are the things to balance. One of the reasons we put out that resource document for parents and caregivers to have them go through a thought process of what they want to consider in putting their children back into school. I don't think as many parents realize what I've tried to say, though, is that there really have been substantial public health negative consequences for children not being in school. And the net thing between, if you put a scale of public health benefit, you're going to see that the public health benefit is far greater by getting these schools reopened than the public health benefit. So it's going to be an individual parent decision. I understand as a parent and now a grandparent of 11 that we all worry. We're hoping that people will see the substantial benefit to their children. And particularly, individuals that have been socially disadvantaged, to get them back in school, get them back learning, get them back with the access to the services that they get at school, which aren't happening, whether it's the 7.1 million, they get mental health services or the number of individuals that get nutritional services or the important services that schools offer to see early signs of child abuse or sexual molestation or just the importance to get individuals interacting more. So they're not isolated. And we have seen, obviously increases in adolescent suicide, adolescent drug use disorder. So I just want to reiterate how important from a public health point of view. And I think once parents see that, they'll make their own decisions. And some parents will step forward initially. But I anticipate that as the schools begin to reopen, more and more parents will begin to opt for the option to have face-to-face learning.
Last question, please, Ted.
Yes, the last question is from Ken Downey with Helio.com. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Dr. Redfield, last week in the CDC press release, it stated that resources and tools will describe what to do to guard against someone who might be sick from infecting others. Can you just kind of highlight what that entails and how you're going to make sure that all schools actually provide this for not only kids, but for staff as well?
Yeah, I think, again, in our guidance, if you go through them, we really tried to address, you know, right at the beginning, because I do believe it's important that we reopen these schools with the understanding that COVID is still here. And gave guidance in terms of how to begin to respond to when a student, for example, develops symptoms or when a student is confirmed to be COVID positive, what is the appropriate response within that classroom, within that school, and begin to work forward, getting people to understand that the knee-jerk answer is not, you know, if there's a single case in a school, that then equals closing back down the school. So we do have some specific guidance in our guidelines on how to begin to do that. It is important for the schools to think that through, how they're going to handle it ahead of time, because when a case is identified in a school, if that's not ahead of time thought through, it can be a very emotional response. We recently saw a university in one of the states that reopened had a single case in the university, and their response was to close the university back down. So, but I think I have to leave it at there.
Thank you, Dr. Redfield. Thank you, Dr. Jason. Thank you, Dr. Salvatat. And thank you all for joining us for today's briefing. Please check CDC's website, www.cdc.gov/COVID-19, for the latest updates on CDC's response efforts. If you have further questions, please call the media line at 404-639-3286 or email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.